This podcast is brought to you by The Shift.
Welcome, 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 everybody. We are delighted to have you here for this week's The Last One to See, where the lovely, the talented Sunita Appiah-Kerrang is the last one to see music classic Almost Famous. David, how are you?
Doing okay, thanks. Yeah, it's been a bit of a busy 2 weeks, but I've been racking up a lot of movie viewings, making a bit of a dent into my award season tracker as well, which has been fun.
Well, speaking of award season, except not at all, in line with one of our previous episodes with Aoife Barry, The sequel to The Texas Chainsaw Massacre has hit Netflix. It's a streamer, I believe.
It is a streamer movie. That's what I'll say.
But is it a screamer as well as a streamer?
Oh, the screams were more in shame and horror than disgust and gore. But yeah, I would definitely relegate this to in the vein of your like very cheesy 90s sequel, like Texas Chainsaw Massacre: The Next Generation. It actually felt far more like that. What we had talked about in the episode about all of the creativeness that the low budget forced the original film to do and the lack of gore that we saw, the creation of mood, how all of that, like that was all kind of thrown out the window. And it was, they did go for some very extreme shots of gore, and even the whole Alwyn Fuere character coming back 40 years later was really shoehorned in. Like, they didn't do it as intelligently as Jamie Lee Curtis coming back in Halloween. So yeah, I'd say stick to the original, guys.
It's for a completists only is what you're telling me.
Yeah, yeah. But how about you? Have you made any dent into your award season?
Not so much award season. Oh, well, actually, I did go and see Belfast with my parents, where I was the only person in the cinema under the age of 60. This quasi-retirement thing I'm on till I start my new job.
Are you sure it wasn't one of those retirement screenings?
I think when it's a screening in the middle of a Tuesday, it is by definition a retirement screening. It's either a parent and baby or retirement. But yeah, really, really enjoyed it. We did all come out and... no shade to her. She is a legend and icon. The three of us came out going, and Judi Dench got an Oscar nomination for that. I think Karine Hines, as his name was butchered in the Oscar noms broadcast, he is sensational. He is incredibly good in that. Jamie Dornan and Katrina Balfe are also great. Very surprised about the... like, there's been obviously chat about the lack of recognition for her, particularly because she was so highly recognised up until that point. I think his omission has kind of slipped under the radar a little bit. And I think, God love him, the man is just cursed with a handsome face. Because even when I compare with how funny he is in, I don't know, one that we watched together, Barb and Star Go to Vista Del Mar, the man does have great range. And I think he's cursed by that 50 Shades role and by looking like a god. But I think he is really good in that. I really, really enjoyed it. Had a little cry, as is my wont. And then seeing it with my parents was really interesting because... they grew up in the Republic, but there's a lot of cultural touchstones in there that have, you know, nothing to do with the Troubles, like things of the time. I will say, Kenneth Branagh, not subtle, because he has the kid reading a Thor comic and then features an Agatha Christie book as well. But like, listen, the man cast the most gorgeous movie stars in the world as his parents, which I will say comes across more as a gesture of love rather than some kind of arrogance on his behalf, is that this is how he saw them. As these beautiful, charismatic people. But yeah, really enjoyed Belfast.
What did you think of the child actor in it? Because I know I've obviously been touting Come On, Come On as my big disappointment of not getting nominated. But in the BAFTAs, the child actor in that got nominated.
He is fantastic. I am in some ways surprised that there has been, again, less kind of stuff around him. But I do wonder, have we come a long way in how we deal with child actors where we're not putting them front and center of, you know, a grueling press campaign? But he has the most beautiful face. He is wonderful. He is so natural. Like, it doesn't, again...
yeah, like, the innocence, like, it really comes through. And
he's very funny. And then his brother as well does a good job, which is a harder role, obviously, because, you know, the kid is the star. And then he has an older brother as well, who is a smaller part. But both, like, they feel like real kids. And I think that's kind of what it stands or falls on. And then just in terms of other bits... unfortunately, I think this is something that's currently going to be only accessible to our Irish listeners. There was a great documentary on RTÉ about the great Vincent Hanley, who was Ireland's first VJ. He was a DJ, but then moved to New York and would present a program about music videos, MTUSA, Music Television USA, which again would have been a massive cultural touchstone of the time. Vincent was a gay man, not publicly out, who contracted AIDS and passed away. And his former producer partner and the great producer, Bill Hughes, fronts this documentary about his life and about his impact. And also, I think it is really easy for us as a nation, certainly the ones here and maybe some of the ones abroad as well, might be aware of, we passed a referendum on marriage equality in 2016, I think it was.
Yeah.
So sometimes I think we're a great little nation, aren't we? But just how incredibly toxic and difficult and illegal it was to be a gay man in Ireland, and then to add to layer the AIDS crisis on top of that. Just what a terribly toxic place Ireland was. And I watched it with my parents, and at one point they were like, God, how did any of us get out alive? And I think it is, it's a beautiful standalone piece as is. I would really recommend that people catch it out. The RT player, unfortunately, is death, but I think it's worth braving it for that.
They certainly know how to serve up the ads, but not the content. That's the one thing.
Yeah, the ads never buffer. Funny that.
Yeah.
And in interest of full disclosure, I did used to work for Mind the Gap. God, how old am I? Like 12 years ago now. And Bill actually gave me one of the greatest professional bits of advice I've ever received, which was, don't be afraid to say, I don't know. And he's absolutely right, because when you're younger, I think you try and spoof your way through things because you think you're supposed to. But I do know that this documentary is very much worth seeing, and directed by Aoife Kelleher, who is probably best known for the beautiful documentary about Glasnevin Cemetery, 1 Million Dubliners. So it's a really strong piece of work. The Iftonoms are also out this week.
Oh, exciting. I haven't got a chance to have a look at them. Anything particularly exciting?
I think the two big things for me were, super shout out to future podcast guest Kate Dolan for her debut, You Are Not My Mother, is nominated for 6 big ones, including for herself, Best Picture, Best Director and Best Screenplay.
I'm very excited. I'll be seeing that this week as part of the Dublin Film Festival, yeah.
And then also just a special shout out for an honorary associate of the podcast, Mr. John Murphy, who is the brother of Kieran Murphy, who was our very first guest on Avatar. And I have been told that uses the fact that Kieran, when put on the spot, could not name a single one of his films as a source of sibling slagging. So I'm delighted that we could provide it. And he did provide the extra layer of information that he and Kieran shared an office for 10 years. And Kieran used to walk past posters of his various output and still couldn't come up with anything on the spot. But a massive shout out to John for his nomination for On Colleen Kuhn, which I know is also playing as part of the film festival. And like a final shout out for a gorgeous doc called Love Yourself Today, which is about the great Irish folk singer Damien Dempsey. And that's directed by Ross Colleen, and it is a Motherland joint. So yeah, really enjoyed that. But that's nominated for Best Documentary, which is a really strong category. So yeah, we can chat a little bit further perhaps next week, David, when you've had time to parse the nominations. But they were the three kind of headline things that came out for me. And yeah, great to see Irish film and television in a really strong place, as is Irish music, David. So tell me where we're going.
So yeah, music is the vibe for this episode. We have our guest Anita Appiah-Corang, who is a singer, songwriter, podcaster, general all-round deadly human being. And she is the last one to see Almost Famous, which is our 2001 Cameron Crowe music touring, well, set in the 70s, extravaganza.
So what goes on tour stays on tour. Will we crack on?
Yes, let's jump into the chats. Sunita, welcome to the podcast. How are you doing today?
I'm well. Thank you for having me. This is exciting.
So the film you picked is Almost Famous. So we're going to kick off with our usual, why did you pick this?
Good question. So I guess it was probably one of the few movies that everyone seemed to have seen, especially when as a teenager, probably younger, maybe preteen teenager, because it was the early noughties that it kind of came out, that I was half interested in seeing. So I guess pretext is I grew up in a family that, like, we had TV from Friday evenings at 7 to like Sunday at 7. And even at that, it would be like 1 or 2 hour blocks. Our family were like pretty strict. So I haven't seen kind of most things, and I've caught up since college and adulthood on most of the big ones.
Is this you basically asking to come back for like season 2 and 3 and 4? Like,
hint, hint.
We can fill in the gaps. It sounds like your family were on a schedule, though. I'm sure you guys were productive with all your free time.
This is it. Like, we had forest kind of Sunday hikes. All the, like, you know, now retrospectively, I'm like, we had a brilliant quality of life and childhood, but I'm constantly missing all kinds of cultural references to like most things that people have seen. I only recently saw Clueless, for instance, and I'm dressing up as Clueless for Halloween. So I'm kind of reliving a certain portion of like my preteen teenage, like, yeah, the cultural things I missed. And Almost Famous was one of those that, again, seemed like it was maybe a bit adult. The style from it I always saw, and I was like, I'm going to pretend that I know what everyone's talking about, but I loved the style from it, and I loved Kate Hudson in my early preteens. So it was one of those ones I was like, I need to see that, but I just haven't given time to it.
Firstly, you're clearly the perfect person to have on this podcast because you have these gaps. You're quite used to feeling like you're the last one to see something.
Yeah, like making up for like a lot of lost knowledge and just like nodding and being like, yeah, and maybe Googling on the spot as to like loosely what the plot of whatever is, and then like citing what one thing I know about it. So yeah, this time I'll hopefully be able to at least, yeah, speak with honesty about it if it ever comes up again.
Awesome. And I think it is an interesting choice because it is, on one hand, I feel like it came out in 2000. It's kind of got a bit of a resurgence as those of us who saw it as teens remember it really fondly, but it's also not on any streaming service at all, so it hasn't really been kind of picked back over. So I think I am super excited. I have seen it, I remember loving it, as I think like any sort of like indie teenager would. And as you say, like, yeah, Kate Hudson, it is, I think, with all due respect to Kate and, you know, How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days and her appearance in Glee and whatever else she's been doing, it is her, like, still her iconic role, I think.
It was a breakout, was it? It felt like it was a breakout.
Yeah, she was nominated for Best Supporting Actress for it as well. Like, it was a very, very iconic role from, like, the jump. You kind of felt like you were watching something iconic being made, which I think is going to be super interesting. And as you say, even that you're aware of her as kind of an iconic character in it, and you're someone that you even kind of identified with when you were younger, with her purely on vibe, basically. Good vibes.
Pure vibes. I was like, this movie seems like it's about groupies, which my mom would never allow me to watch, but I'm kind of into it. And one of my best friends was like really like a big Kate Hudson fan, but especially that movie, like all throughout her teens, she was just like, I just want to break away and, like, you know, follow about her. And I was like, I don't know what you're talking about, girl, but yeah.
Chase your dreams. We support.
You know, I love that jacket that she wore, you know.
In terms of what you know about it, you've mentioned Kate Hudson. What's your impression of that style, or like the image you kind of have in your head when you think about it? Like the aesthetic, or the, like, what is that vibe you kind of tune into about it?
It was like one of the first cultural touch points that I had when I was like cognizant of the 70s being a cool era and maybe listening to music of that time, you know. So like I think my mind just kind of computes, oh, the 70s was cool and this is like something made, you know, now, whatever, 20 years ago, that gives me the essence of that era and rock and roll, and I'm interested in that now and it means something to me. And like, me, my friends are growing up and being like, wouldn't that be cool? Obviously it's not, you know, it was not something that was on offer at the time and probably would never be, like groupies and all that is like such a forgotten type of culture or happening. And yeah, I guess like I'm a musician, so like any kind of movie that was related to music, rock and roll lifestyle, and especially that era, which became all the more interesting to me when I was a preteen teenager, was just like, yeah, immediately stuck with me.
I think what is slightly terrifying thought to me is that the teenagers who are around our age when that film came out, they would be looking for a film about the 90s.
Word.
And that's how we view the 70s. It's their 90s. So
let's put it in context. Someone I was talking to, I had like an interview thing with other musicians that are closer to my age, but there was a young coming like rapper who was just like, yeah, someone's been like egging me on to listen to Tupac for like years, and you know, I wouldn't listen to that old school stuff, but then I eventually did. He's really good, you know. And I was like backing into the wall and trying not to melt with mortification. I was like, Tupac is vintage? That's really rude.
The beef is no longer East versus West. It is generational, I'm afraid. So.
And appropriately, they're in production for that 90s show as a spinoff from that 70s show at the moment. Yeah, and they're bringing back the parents into the new one, which...
Yeah, that's just weird. Like, yeah, watching TV and like computing the 90s as being retro is just a bit wild, especially just because like 90s style and all those kind of like cultural quirks are like back in. So I'm like, why are you doing this?
Just to circle back on something that you mentioned earlier, obviously that you are a musician and that this is a film about musicians. Do you think it is quite a beloved film for musicians? Have other musicians mentioned it to you?
Like, I guess so. Obviously I can't speak for other musicians other than myself really, but I definitely like, yeah, I definitely would imagine that it would probably, yeah, it would probably draw a certain focus. Like, speaking to just my experience anyway, in terms of reading books or watching TV or just consuming any bit of media, anything that painted a picture of what it was like being a rock star or a musician in any, you know, in any capacity was of particular interest. When I think about movies that were made about rock and roll lifestyles and famous musicians, like, there aren't really that many that come to mind, to be fair. So I feel like it's probably in some sort of a canon, like aside from being a bio of like a particular artist, which I feel like we're only seeing more of in terms of, you know, Bohemian Rhapsody recently and the Elton John one. Like, I feel like they're kind of recent. So like,
and they're basically jukebox musicals as well. Now, I did enjoy the Elton John one, Bohemian Rhapsody.
I haven't seen that. Have I seen it? Bohemian Rhapsody, I have seen, but the Elton John one, I have not. But you see, yeah, again, I'm like...
In the spirit of the podcast, she hasn't seen it.
Well, what's interesting about this is the fact that it's a fictional band as well, because, like, obviously all the ones you've talked about, people have these points of reference, and there's a lot of comparison, I think, even of, like, did the actor emulate this person correctly?
And it's based on Cameron Crowe, the director, going on tour. I think it was with Crosby, Stills and Nash. So as a 15-year-old and writing for the Rolling Stone, but as David says, I think you get a lot of license. I think there is some beautifully nuanced characters, and also then that they've put them in this very real, very vibrant world, you know, like talking about like David Bowie, even stuff like the Riot House, which was the Hyatt Hotel that, you know, everybody would have stayed in. And then you've got like that they do draw on like the idea of famous groupies like Pamela Disparis and whatever. So like, I think it is a really rich tapestry, but then you also have an element of like character creation as well, and maybe a little bit of plausible deniability that you're kind of stealing little bits from here and there, but nobody's going to be able to sue you.
Exactly. Yeah, you're not really held accountable to it. So yeah, I guess, yeah, it was definitely that appeal of there are probably very few movies of that particular styling that's focused on kind of a whole era and the ins and outs of like rock and roll lifestyle and what it meant.
Thinking about your own experience, do you have any stories of things that went down when like touring or doing shows with your band that if you had an aspiring journalist following you around would have been a sensational story?
Oh, interesting. Spill the tea. Like, not really. Like, most of our touring would have been to like festivals in Ireland. We planned on doing a tour just before the pandemic in the UK and a couple of places in Europe, but it didn't pan out. That like, as sensational as it gets is really just the lads. I was in a band of five people. Well, it went from like nine people at one point to five ultimately. But yeah, as much of the dirt is that like one of the lads played a prank on me in which they lied or fabricated this whole scenario that the guitarist got stopped by a guard on the way over and was essentially arrested, and that I had to like try and talk the guard down from taking him to the police station, and basically one of the other lads in the car was pretending to be it. So like pranks and things like that, but nothing actually dramatic, thankfully.
Do you think people think touring is a lot more glam than it actually is?
It is a lot more, yeah, exactly. It is, it's conflated as being way more, you know, way cooler than, like, I guess also it's just a different landscape, you know. Even like the idea of a music critic following a band around the place to like capture their, you know, their lifestyle, like that whole cultural thing is totally lost. Like, now we have social media, you have a direct insight into most of the artists' lives, you know. So if there was a mystique around like rock and roll, the 70s, certain eras and what went down truly, because there were, you know, a couple people that were like, that had access enough to be, you know, giving you those anecdotes, like that whole thing is lost. Yeah, and in the same way, like rock and roll and the glamour of it is probably lost to some degree. It's way more practical and logical now. I think that the only thing that could be interesting really now is like the drams. So like, you know, the only thing I could be dishing that was like anyway interesting now would be like, oh, myself and the lads were like constantly fighting, which thankfully wasn't the case. But yeah, that's probably as much color interest that I could add.
Although it's funny to say about like different to now, did you ever hear about, it happened in about 2013, Rihanna had this thing, it was called like the 777 tour.
I heard of it, yeah.
She did, it was like seven countries, seven shows in 7 days.
Yeah.
And right. She had a group of journalists like come with her on the flights and everything around the place. And
I remember that. And then she had like the trip and stuff. Yeah, I remember all of that.
But like in recent years, that's the closest thing I've heard to anything like this.
Well, this is it. I was just going to say that like there's even a massive, you know, generational and cultural jump between that 777 tour, because like much as it was that we still had like paparazzi and a certain degree of social media, like Rihanna wasn't interacting with us on the same, she still isn't interacting with us on any level that gives.
Drop the music, Rihanna. We love you. Well done on the underwear and the makeup. Drop the tunes.
She's telling us only things that help her profit and continue to be the billionaire that she is. And she's probably one of the few billionaires that I would, you know, give that pass to. But like, but even at that point, you know, social media, like the way that celebrities basically engage and use social media and media overall is totally different to now. Like she didn't have a TikTok, she didn't have a Snapchat. Whereas there's an expectation now that all of these artists will go live and give you this like real,
from the
like,
heart,
real live, yeah, live and direct kind of invitation to their lives. And there's a, you know, otherwise paparazzi culture was the only thing that was like, even paparazzi culture is like a little bit dead in the sense of they're catching up on what was already shared on social media because they have.
I think it's ironic that this film obviously came out around 2000 because that was such a toxic era to be a celebrity, particularly obviously a female celebrity. And as you say, now you have the direct conversation, but then the onus has become on the celebrity, the artist, and especially when it comes to music, you know, people are artists, but you also have to perform as yourself for your audience, which is must be very different. And do you feel any pressure in that way to like engage through social media and like let people into your life in a way that perhaps you wouldn't be 100% comfortable with?
The fine line for me, I suppose, is that, you know, like probably all of us generationally grew up with social media to a certain degree. So like the transition of to what degree we allow it to be embedded in our lives and to communicate with it probably feels less stark than our parents, for instance, and also maybe less natural than like the TikTok generation, right? But I think that the big difference in how I look at it now is that artists are kind of expected across the board probably to be more so their marketeers. And that's the piece that I think is like, is interesting, both in terms of how people leverage that to build community and kind of really speak to their brand and the line between being a brand and being a person, or being both as well, where your whole brand is just like really giving yourself entirely to your social media community. I think for me, the parts that I'm tentative about is exactly that, like what's the line for myself, that I'm being authentically myself. Where does the line of definition kind of get blurred where I am constantly performing myself and my selfhood to the point of not knowing really and then living on the internet and what are the drawbacks of that to mental, you know, just general well-being. I think that that's kind of where I constantly live in the place of like kind of concern and trying to strike a good balance. But yeah, I'm very interested in how that influences like actual, the impact of the music and the access, you know, that it has for you know, people out there and the barriers that come with not being able to do that well.
And I suppose even on the creation side, are you thinking about what has appeal and is there nearly too much knowledge about the metric side of things of music and not just letting it kind of naturally form in that way?
Yeah, I mean, like when it comes to actually making music itself, like I guess I'm very separate from it and I enjoy that process and I still do well. But like, yeah, ultimately at the same time, because of the fact that I feel like we have like a unique advantage of I still can enjoy doing that. I can still enjoy being in a studio and whatever comes out of it without feeling that I had to like document that I was there and did it happen at all if I didn't. But I also really, I guess like circling back, I suppose, to the Almost Famous thing and why a movie like that would be appealing. I still appreciate the element of mystique around celebritydom or like around musicians or around people that I admire, right? Whereas there's a different expectation now that like putting yourself forward and kind of like selling yourself in whatever brand or, you know, whatever way that you want to do that, be it that you create an alter ego or that you're authentically yourself, that is so much more, it has so much more capital to it. And for me, the capital came from not really knowing and making up your own story. Like Beyonce is still like a superstar to me because she gives us what we want in terms of content. I love seeing her in her yacht and her three, you know, her three grid kind of posts, but like she's never giving you anything of what's actually going on.
I find Beyonce so relatable.
You just see him there outside of Wow Burger with his like diamante
swinging my baseball bat in my big yellow dress.
Anyway, I think we could go on indefinitely making fun of David, so I think we'll probably draw a line under there. I am fascinated for you to see this film because even in your last answer there and throughout the conversation, you have drawn on so many threads that I think are going to be like the idea of, you know, creating identities and things like that. I think that are going to be so in and the creative process and the effect of relationships within the band on the creative process. I do think you're going to get a lot out of this film. I don't want to prejudice you or like have you going in with things, but I am fascinated to pick it up with you later after you go on your trip to the 70s and check out Almost Famous.
I'm very excited. I'm just hoping that it's not going to be in any way. Like, that's the thing. The one thing I'm afraid of watching old movies is this problematic all of a sudden. And now can I never love it in the way that I wanted to? But I anticipate that it will not be.
It wouldn't be one of the choices that people have picked that springs forth as the most problematic. But they are the type of issues that we're going to be chatting about, as well as just, did you like it?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, there's going to be a twofold question there. Excited.
We'll enjoy it and we'll have you in the studio soon and we can deconstruct it all then. That's it for the preamble. So here is your courtesy warning that we're about to get into spoiler territory.
Lovely. So welcome back to the studio, Sunita. You are now no longer the last one to see Almost Famous.
Yeah, I know. I've crossed over that line of
Although, Almost Famous, Jerry. I have a confession to make.
Tell me.
So as part of The Last Man to See, we have always endeavoured to make sure that we secure copies of the film for our guests to watch.
Okay.
And the copy of the film that we as a group have seen, you may have noticed during the title cards, which are done as a kind of like handwritten.
Yes.
The words Almost Famous don't actually appear in the version you saw. The word Untitled appears.
Ah.
Because we watched what's referred to as the bootleg cut. It's the director's cut of
That's
the
why
movie.
It's 2 hours and 40
really?
Minutes.
Yeah.
So I will confess as well that I ended up not watching the version that was reserved for me. I just watched it on Now TV. Sorry, this is not hashtag spawns.
Okay, right.
So my housemate sourced it for me through legal means.
Excellent. Okay.
But what did I miss out on?
So there's 40 minutes of additional content in the bootleg cut.
Okay.
Now, some of these scenes are like just extensions or slightly.
Yeah, there wasn't a huge amount that I didn't remember seeing the first time. If that makes sense. It wasn't anything where I was like, where the hell
this
is that?
This has fundamentally changed the whole.
But I definitely just did want to set that up in case either Kate and I say anything that you, Sunita, to have no understanding and have no memory of what happened in the movie. And also for the listeners, in case they have only seen the original.
And
as
also
well.
For me to explain. And why I was like, David, why is this 2 hours and 40 minutes? And you just said, oh yeah, it is a long one.
When you
it?
Said that it was long, I was like, it was like, you know, we went through a journey.
To be fair, you were like, how short is this woman's attention span? 2 hours is not that bad.
So okay, that now that the air has been cleared on that one, Sunita, can you give us a summary of the plot of Almost Famous?
Okay, I'll give it to you as quick as I can give it. Almost Famous is a coming of age story of a bunch of 15, 16-year-old teenagers that essentially go on tour with this up-and-rising band, one of which and is the kind of central narrator of the story and is this kind of protege journalist that's like earning his stripes writing for a prestigious nationwide famous magazine. I can't remember what the name of it was called.
He initially, Cream was the one that he had done originally stuff for, but he actually gets commissioned by Rolling Stone, the Rolling Stone magazine, as they repeatedly tell us.
By the way, I like music and I have heard of Rolling Stone.
I feel it's important to clear that up. Yeah, so and there are obviously real characters from Rolling Stone, like all those editors and stuff that we see are based on real people, but please continue.
Yeah, exactly. So basically, once in a lifetime opportunity for him to, one, I think initially write like an article or write an interview with this band, but then ultimately goes on tour, making it like into kind of a wider feature and just journeys through all of the peaks and troughs of following a band in the 70s. Who are trying to make it and battling with all of their egos and insecurities.
I think that last line in particular nailed it, because it is within this band you have Russell, who is the charismatic, extremely handsome, good lord, really incredible, very handsome man, guitarist, and then you have Jeff, the lead singer, who's played by Jason Lee, and it was he put together the band. It was originally the Jeff Beebe Band, which is his name. At one point he is wearing a t-shirt with his own face on it, which I found very entertaining. But it is also like Russell is arguably the real talent of the band and is apparently a sick guitarist, bruh. And there is this massive tension between the two of them as well, and you really see that coming apart. And it is, you know, the film is Almost Famous, they are on the Almost Famous tour, and it is very much a band that is on the cusp of stardom. And they obviously get more, you see like from the crowds that they're playing for, from then in the film they switch from like a bus to a plane, a cool hip Gunslinger manager played by Jimmy Fallon in his
I couldn't believe Jimmy Fallon was playing.
It's his first role where he's not Jimmy Fallon, basically, where he had done Saturday Night Live, the Fallon show didn't exist, or
he did represent the sleazy embodiment of capitalism that Kate and I so vehemently opposed.
It was capitalism
at all times
all along. But I think a huge part of the tension in the film is between those two central characters. We do need to discuss Miss Penny Lane.
Of course. I think there was also like another kind of underlying tension as well, that kind of was central to the theme of being almost famous, right? So like 100%. Just the dude, I can't remember, I'm so bad at names, guys, you're gonna have to like remind me, but the journalist's like role,
William Miller,
in documenting that, like,
he was only 16 when he made this film,
exactly, and like much as he was like this, you know, unassuming 16-year-old like earnest guy, they constantly had to remind themselves of him being the enemy.
They call him the enemy as a joke, and there is that here I am, the one guy telling. Here I am telling secrets to the one guy you're not supposed to tell secrets to.
Right.
Because, and I think it is actually quite important in the film that he was actually so young because he looks so young.
Right.
There is no sort of like Beverly Hills 90210, Dawson's Creek thing where you're like, this man is 45 playing a teenager. It yeah. is that. And he kind of reminds me a bit of Elijah Wood in Lord of the Rings.
Right.
Because there, he has nothing, but he doesn't have like, you know, an instrument, he doesn't have whatever, but these big wide eyes that take everything in, and right. he's so reactive yeah. to everybody, and he's trying to learn how to exist in this world that he's been obsessed with for a long time, and he's kind of watching and mimicking and taking on board, yeah. but also, like, you know, they do say through the whole thing, like, he is a special kid, he is a yeah. good kid and whatever, and kind of trying to stay true to himself throughout it. So I think, yeah, that is like a tension in the film as well, and as he says, he is fundamentally uncool.
Speaking of youth as well, though, I feel yeah. like so Kate Hudson at the time of yeah. playing this role was only about 21.
I was wondering how old she was at that time, because she is a yeah. baby. Like, that's as fresh faced as I've seen her. That was a breakout role, right?
Totally. Yeah. And yeah. that, like, one thing that kind of my thought of it always comes back to Britney. For a 21-year-old, she has this like older than her years but still really youthful yeah. embodiment in the character, where yeah. there's like a wisdom, or just like, she doesn't seem like a babyish 21-year-old.
Yeah.
She seems like younger than we know Kate Hudson ever to
yeah,
have been.
Yeah, yeah.
But
ever in her life, she came ever.
She
yeah.
just arrived. Yeah. But like, similarly, I kind of always see Britney in that same light, where it's just Ooh. Like she showed up and she was like pop star ready to go, and like Kate Hudson was,
I think,
like,
that Kate Hudson had a different advantage, and that was something that was playing in my mind while watching it, was just like, Kate Hudson is like the child of like Goldie Hawn, and like, so like, she probably has like the most exposure to any of this in reality, as far as like growing up with famous parents out of that time, and knowing just the trepidations of like
fame,
of ego, of like all of
That's
these temptations
really
and things.
Point, yeah.
And so like, much as she's like earnest and young and like the youngest that we've ever seen her, there was like a knowingness that I felt that
she's
just
been a bystander
sat.
To fame in
exactly.
her own
She's overheard the dinner party conversations while she was supposed to be in
she's
bed.
She's seen the pictures. She's been in the like the room with the kind of whatever the seat that's the floor kind of, you know, she's she kind of has, yeah, some like little insight as to the whole scenario.
And speaking of real life, I think one of the, to be honest, I could talk to you for about 7 hours about this film. I hadn't seen it in a long time. I loved it.
Yeah.
But William Miller is very much an avatar for the director, Cameron Crowe, who, when he was also exceptionally young, went on tour with Led Zeppelin, went on tour with Crosby, Stills and Nash.
Yeah.
And it was very much that person and that character.
Yeah.
And then even I went into a groupie deep dive after watching this. And
do you think,
you know,
it was based on a specific person?
Well, they say it was based on, there was Penny Lane, only it's spelled IE, and I think her name was Penny Turnbull. But Pamela de Barres, who would probably be queen of the groupies and would have written the book I'm with the Band, which would be kind of the seminal story of being a groupie in the 70s, and she's always been on a mission to take back the word groupie as, you know, being something that she always found empowering. And Kate Hudson, I was about to say Kate Winslet, the Kate multiverse, told her that she had, you know, read her book as inspiration, that she had pictures of her on the wall. And then there's also the other name that gets thrown into the pot as inspiration for the character is it either Beebe Buell, who is actually the mother of Liv Tyler, whose father is Steven Tyler. So they were very much and had relationships with Jimmy Page and, you know, all of these lads. They were all just bopping around, you know.
Yeah.
That's so 70s.
Yeah, very much. And also, Pamela de Barres is really, I haven't read the book, but I've read a couple of interviews with her, and just how, like, this was before John Lennon was shot, and these guys were, and you do see that in the great scene where Russell just goes to a random house party.
I know.
They were incredibly accessible. Like, the closest I can think of it is when Daniel Radcliffe was in Dublin and ended up going to a house party with, like, I think it was like a junior B football team that had just won a cup.
Are you kidding me? That happened.
They met him in the street after he'd been in Lily's or somewhere, and they were just like, ridiculous. Do you want to come to ours for afters? And he was just like, sure.
I feel there's also a similar story of like Will Ferrell ending up like in a like rural
in Ireland, like
Irish pub, just like having the band.
That kind of thing I would definitely expect a little bit more of, just because of the fact that there would be that little bit of anonymity, maybe, or just that parochial feel of like, let's see how these people live out in the West.
Yeah.
But like, down to like a house party in Dublin with some lads that
the photos are very funny. And also, like, he doesn't carry money. He didn't have any money to pay for like the taxi or anything like that. And he had a very large security man who also
did he? Yeah, because I was just like, well, how did he get about?
Yeah, exactly. But sorry, we could, you know, not, we could go on a tangent of, yeah, famous
we've
people.
Digressed, we've digressed.
Yeah, famous but people still, having, you know, adventures, yeah, around around Ireland. I do think one of the things that really endures with Almost Famous is how incredibly evocative of that time. It's 1973 in the film. I think the production design, the wardrobe, and also I am an extremely sentimental person. This is an extremely sentimental film, clearly for the director or whatever, but damn it, it works as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, so transportative. Like, I just found it interesting that you were saying that it revealed an accessibility that these people, well, I guess they were almost famous, so they weren't fully famous. Yeah, an accessibility that these, you know, that these bands or artists would
and
have,
these fans had access fans to.
Like even just the notion of a groupie in itself is kind of super novel nowadays. And then on the other hand, I felt like the nostalgia of it really just played into, for me, an era that you hear about so much, basically from like kind of the 80s and backwards to like the 50s, like the dawn of rock and roll, the dawn of pop culture, and then just like this craze of people going on tour internationally and nationally in the US and such, but like also it feeling very distant from like everyday life, and that there was this bubble
running away to join the circus and no one ever wants to say goodbye,
exactly, and like everyone fantasized about it, everyone had their notions about it. So like, you know, the journalist name whose name escapes me again,
William Miller's
like very presence as a journalist kind of following them was just so novel, and we're so reliant on every single anecdote, every detail that he documents of their lives, which is just not true for nowadays. From our lives onwards
as well. I think that it's interesting about like that aspect of the accessibility, and even the idea of the band wanting to kind of reach out to the fans and the public like that and hearing it, because the way that they frame the journalists as being the enemy. There's a nearly a distrust of like what's being written.
The stakes
as, like,
are
that's
high,
not the real opinion.
They are nearly famous. Like
and
in actuality.
Conflict,
but like,
and again, Jeff actually talks about it very well. It's like they ruined Bowie. They did A, B, and C.
Right.
But it'd be really cool to be on the cover, wouldn't it? So
there you go.
It is that whole dichotomy of they're very aware of the risks of what they're doing, but they also A, really like him, and B, they want to get something out of this, you know?
Exactly.
So there is kind of trying to balance all of those things. So we've touched on kind of our main trio, which are Patrick Fugit as William Miller, the journalist, Kate Hudson as Miss Penny Lane, Queen of the Band-Aids, and then you have Billy Crudup as Russell Hammond. But I think we do have to talk about the two towering character actor performances that are in this, from two incredible actors, one of whom unfortunately is no longer with us, with Philip Seymour Hoffman and his portrayal of Lester Bangs, who was a real person, and Frances McDormand as William's mother, who was not, but oh my god, she is wild,
incredible
in
character. Loved whenever she like whenever she whipped him into Russell into shape on the phone. I was just like, yeah, you freak.
And how much
out.
Obviously they both, you see them both in the intro in the first, you know, first act, shall we say, of the film, where William's at home and you see that his mother, who's a college professor, is a massively domineering presence.
Oh, and Zooey Deschanel is sister.
Yeah, I know, what a cast.
We were talking, I would love to see the spin-off movie of her like Pan Am career.
Yeah.
Like that's if anyone's
that outfit
talking
at the
sequels,
end alone is fabulous. But just to circle back to Frances, you do see she's a brilliant presence, but also a very domineering presence in their lives. And it turns out she has spent William's entire life lying about his age, and he finds out that he's 11 when all his classmates and whatever are 13.
Yeah.
And when he finds that out, it's really funny. But her thing is, I've given you two extra years of your life. She is. And then you see her in the intro sequence, and then she also, Zooey Deschanel, storms out of the house, fueled by Simon and Garfunkel. I did find it hilarious when the mum is like, this is her code for like hedonistic party people.
They're stoned.
And we are a big Simon and Garfunkel household, but if I was like, I'm not going to put the lads up there with Black Sabbath in terms so I think like and also so much of her performance, and also Philip Seymour Hoffman's performance later becomes these phone calls, which is incredible.
I love that. That was a presence again that like I felt was like such a lovely kind of reminder of this. Reminder to
William Miller's
character himself, like don't fall into the
traps, a tether to home, exactly
like don't fall into the traps of temptation of thinking that you're actually friends and part of this world,
and that is very much Lester's thing, is like these people are not your friends, they will make you think that you're friends but they're not, and you need to be ruthlessly honest.
I guess it was like there's a number of different kind of like push and pull factors happening here as to like just generally identity growing up and the pretense of like being an adult and knowing the ways of the world.
And as you say, pretense, because the Rolling Stone do not know they've sent a 15-year-old on tour.
Right, exactly. Like him just like, yeah, putting on his like big man's voice, whatever, on the phone whenever he's checking in. So there's like, I felt like, I guess the main appeal for me trying to kind of think of myself watching this as a teenager at the time whenever it was so big and whenever loads of my friends were obsessed with it and the style of it is just the fact that it hits, it kind of, one, I guess it plays on this like fantastical situation where you as a teenager at 15 or 16 could be a voyeur and privy to this world, because if I ran away, I'm sure the guys would have found me within no time anyway. And then two,
I am not equipped to survive in that environment.
Yeah, exactly. And like two, if I ran away at 15 and 16, like I feel like a bunch of really negative things would have happened to me if I was trying to pursue the lifestyle of a groupie in the time and age that we grew up in. Mm-hmm. Whereas it just kind of created this like really farcical but romantic sense of running away and then straight away being able to be an adult and carving this like fabulous life. And it really just mirrored like what my fantasy of running away and being independent at the age that
I definitely think, like, yeah, the first time I watched the movie, I saw myself in the William Miller character just like, I want to do that and I want to run away and that,
exactly,
like, I want to finally be cool.
Yeah,
exactly.
But now watching it, I definitely felt a little more Lester Bangs.
Yeah, and this Frances McDormand being like, and you know, when she basically reads the riot act to Russell on the phone and by the and he's like, hey, I'm a super cool rock guitarist, and by the end he's going, yes ma'am, ma'am, or whatever, and I'm like, you damn well better get him home safely, Russell.
Exactly.
But that, the Lester line of course I'm home, I'm like,
I'm uncool,
the uncool thing, I was just like, oh, I feel seen, like,
this
that
is
was,
it. Yeah, exactly, like, yeah,
that was real.
It's like all of these different kind of I guess, yeah, massive themes of growing up whenever you're a teenager and coming of age and trying to figure out as to like what's cool, is being uncool cool and liking music and having integrity and like being a Puritan about like music and all these different things, or can you, like, how fickle are we to get completely swayed by the beauty of a Penny Lane and by the allure and enigma of a Russell
of all these incredible people. And then, as you said, push and pull, what the band want him to write and what Rolling Stone want him to write are very different things as well. And also he's trying to impress all of these people equally.
Got so many stakeholders at 15 to try and deliver to.
And I think even that thing of like, kind of as each generation comes through, what you think as good music, you kind of feel like you're the first one to have discovered it. And then when the next generation rolls in with their opinion of like what's good now, it's very easy to fall into the Lester, like, it's all dead. I remember the good times.
I know.
Like,
but then again, I think one thing that we've learned from this film is the good stuff survives.
Yeah,
you know,
the
songs that we like, that probably the most iconic scene in the film is that Tiny Dancer sing along. Like, that still slaps.
That was so gorgeous,
and it's so beautifully done as well.
And the whole way through that, just seeing how it hits each character and just like their little like moment where they like, I'll join in.
And also like major shout out to Anita, because I'm a big sister and I ain't leaving my sisters my vinyl. I'm just saying, like, I think that is like a very serious sacrifice.
Now, admittedly, vinyl was a lot cheaper back then. I think we're in premium pricing at the moment.
Would
have been a more dispensable commodity in that time.
Or on the other hand, like more of a significant, like, I'm leaving you.
Yeah, and that is her, you know, like, light a candle, listen to Tommy, and you'll see the future. And the real transformative, that is the real transformative moment of the film. Going on tour with the band is a result of that, but she's actually the one who does change his life.
Yeah, and one day you're going to be cool. And like here he had this like crazy experience to go on tour with a band that were really pivotal at
and
that age.
De-virginized by three beautiful women. Yeah.
So wait, so like,
are you okay?
My mind was like split in two throughout watching it. So like I very much was trying to center myself in, I'm 15, seeing this for the first time, now connecting with why it's such a big deal, like in the context of hearing about it so much. And then the other side of it, and I was watching it with my really good friend who had watched it as a teenager and is still now pursuing a Penny Lane, you know, jacket.
Who is not? One of the top 10 greatest coasts of cinema.
They're hard to find. They're a sought for thing on the internet and really expensive. But the other side of it is that where you're watching it now and just being like, please just don't be problematic, I just want to remember you fondly, was her prayer. And I was just like, I just don't want to be like wildly uncomfortable about this while also like enjoying many aspects of the romanticizing of this era and all of these different themes. And so like a couple of things that kind of just came to mind was just like, just the notion of groupies and the fact that there were these like circle of, you know, young girls that all of these bands and artists were familiar with, like having slept with or just been on, you know, done the rounds with, and they were all like 14, 15, 16 or so. It was alluding
there were
to,
some,
you know?
Like Pamela Desbarres was of age when she was having all these relationships, but somebody like Laurie Maddox, who would have been known, or Star Sable, who would have been known as one of the baby groupies, she, I don't want to say alleges, but this is one that there isn't documented proof of. She lost her virginity to David Bowie. She was, this there is proof of, she was in a relationship with Jimmy Page for a year when she was like 14, 15 and he was an adult man. And she, and it's interesting to look at the kind of groupie experience, whatever, in the Me Too era. And it's something that I am cautious about talking about, because Laurie Maddox has like talked about it, and she says, I had a great time, I always felt safe, I felt respected. She's like, would now I want a daughter of mine or whatever to be doing that? No. So like, I don't think it's for me to tell these women that these experiences were something that they weren't. But having said that, I think we can all very definitively say men in their 20s should not be having sex with 15-year-old girls.
And I think even the poker scene kind of...
Oh yeah, we will have to talk about
that. They do inject a moment in the film of a kind of conscience about it all. And that like that it's not just giving it a free pass the whole way through.
I think... And I think it is like you've really been suckered into being like they're all this one big family, and then at a pivotal moment in the film, the three Band-Aids get given away famously for $50 and a case of Heineken.
Right.
And there is that, and I do think to again circle back to this being an incredible performance from Kate Hudson when William Miller, who is in love with her, like blurts out and says this, there is an incredible range of acting, and then she wipes away a tear and goes, what kind of beer? Which is a just like, it is a really,
it was
really
a powerful moment. Like, because that's
like
I think for like in that moment, much as it is, you know, you don't get that much of a giveaway as to her back story.
She has at the very beginning of the film said, it's what I tell the girls, don't tell it too, take it too seriously. If you don't take it too seriously, you always have fun. If you always have fun, you don't get hurt.
Really,
and she's kind
of
broken her own rules by very much falling in love with Russell. And like, good lord, they are the most beautiful couple. You're just looking at them and you're being like, they are two such gorgeous human beings together.
And such like in opposite direction, kind of slightly broken but also like really compelling characters. You know, she's full of the stories and she's this like, you know, enigmatic mystery woman that's just knowing, well, mystery young girl woman that's like knowing of the world, and then on the other side he's just like trying to find the purest experience, and you know,
he's
both
a bit of a wanker
different...
in fairness, like, and he does part of the reason the Band-Aids are given away is as Stillwater the band approach New York, his ex-wife current girlfriend will be waiting for him there. He's been having an affair with Penny Lane all summer, which we are led to believe was also the case last summer. And then part of the reason he discards her is because he's going back to like his real life, you know. And I think that, and then she makes her own way to New York, and you have that incredibly touching scene in, I think it's like a diner or like bar diner kind of thing, where she is there and their manager basically has to go over and tell her to leave. And the whole thing about the Band-Aids is that they are massive, massive music fans. They're not interested, allegedly, in sleeping with rock stars because they're famous men. They are inspired by their music, and it's very much the idea of groupie as muse.
I always kind of wondered, like, with the groupie culture and just even with this, with this particular movie and the portrayal of it, like in some ways it seemed as if they were interested in the music and were kind of really attached to the notion of like being a muse and pouring to, you know, like giving to the culture in another way. But I also was just like, it also is just like a scapegoat thing of like living the experience of being in the band while not being able to like,
and also I think we do need to be, it's not that, you know, you had like the Slits and whatever, and even Pamela Desbarres was in the GTOs briefly as they existed, but women weren't really in bands. So if you wanted to, you know, other than let's say you're Steve and Christine and Fleetwood Mac and whatever, and you had Mamas and Papas, but it was, these rock bands were overwhelmingly all male affairs. So if you did want to run away with the circus, this was, if
this
you're
the best
young
means.
And hot, this was your best shot.
And I guess like what it also centered then, like let's say like with that knowledge and then that scene where they're playing poker and basically negotiating what they, you know, which
the worth of these women.
But that's the thing, I was just like, oh, they're like, they're just kind of currency in a sense from the guy's perspective. Like, and then it tied to like a real story that my, I think my husband and I were talking about, one of the guys in Led Zeppelin apparently like essentially bought a 14-year-old girl or something, that he paid her parent money to be like, just allow her to go.
Well, I think there's two things happening there. There's potentially Laurie Maddox, who was Jimmy Page's 14-year-old girlfriend.
Yeah.
But then it could also be Bill Wyman of the Rolling Stones, who married a 13-year-old. Or at least they were 13 when she met. But actually, no, because her mother gave, she was definitely underage when they got married. Like, maybe they got married at like 15 because her mother gave permission. So there could be something.
Well, this is it. It's
there.
Just like the layers of like how many instances did this happen, and like,
yeah.
And like, it's a totally different mindset. So like, it's not that I'm kind of trying to accentuate like this is terrifying.
Yeah.
I can totally get as well, knowing myself whenever I was a preteen teenager, just being like, yeah, like,
I think like we'd all lose our virginity to David Bowie given the opportunity. I mean,
right, exactly. And it's just, I guess, the knowledge of now being like, okay, obviously that's just like, it's not the decision that you're kind of,
yeah. And also there is that idea, leaving aside the age thing for a second, it's a complete power dynamic mismatch,
right? Exactly.
As well.
That's exactly it. Like, even if you wanted to, the power dynamic is totally off to make
and
that
these
decision.
People and the William's mother says it about him, but it's like he worships you people, but
yeah.
So did these girls as well.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And
yeah.
There is also, even when, so I think we do also, we'll go back to talking about how there is kind of an overdose scene that I think there's a lot to talk about in there. But also when Russell realizes he's made a mistake and rings Penny Lane, he's like, I want to see myself like you see me. I'm never as good as I am with you. There is very little by way of apology. There's nothing about what she wants. And then she, in a like absolute baller move, sends him to William's door, who he has absolutely fucked over by denying all of his story, which was all true.
Which I thought was so interesting. I was like, was that actually the nature of like foolproofing any of these articles, that you ring the source of and you're like,
everything did have to be fact checked. Like, I think you might get away with something, you know, let's say if there was a crime and there was like, oh, this witness says you did it, you know, something of those nature. But yeah, there was, things had to be fact checked, because otherwise, obviously, you could say anything about anybody, and then that gets into a morally and legally dubious universe.
Place. Yeah, yeah, no, yeah. I guess just like it coming from the actual source. Yeah,
it did make me slightly question the idea, though, of how are you calling these people the enemy if you still have that power, the veto power, kind of at the end.
Yeah. But it very much sounded like that they didn't know they had that until Jimmy Fallon, their new smoothie manager. So basically, they had rung everybody and they'd all been freaking out, going, oh my God, oh my God. And they hadn't gotten hold of Russell yet.
Yeah.
And we also have to remember, this was like a pre-mobile phone age. So God knows, like, they were trying to ring these people backstage in venues.
Yeah.
Same with his mother trying to desperately keep up with her child. There was no Find My Phone, you know.
Yeah.
But their smoothie manager, Jimmy Fallon, and noted hit and run activist based in this film, that this guy has actually killed a man, or potentially killed a man, he says Russell can deny it, and they go, can we do that? Like, they didn't even know that this was possible.
Yeah.
So I think there are a couple of pivotal scenes that have kind of come up that we haven't talked about. I think firstly, we have talked about the wonderful sing-along on the bus, but in terms of modes of transport, their near-death experience on the plane, which is Penny Lane has been and the Band-Aids have been discarded.
Yeah.
Leslie, his ex-wife, current girlfriend, or like basically his real relationship, shall we say, is on the plane. They have all upgraded. They've abandoned Doris, the tour bus. They're all on this plane, and they end up in the middle of an electrical storm.
Mm.
And truths are told. How did that resonate with you? What did you think of that scene?
Yeah, I thought it was hilarious. I thought it was like I guess it was kind of a big climatic moment in which essentially the truth of the nature of the relationship.
And like you said, all these push and pulls that had been set up throughout the film in the face of, and it does look, it's terrifying because it is, you know, a 1970s prop plane. So you are kind of like, how is that thing in the sky to begin with, let alone in the middle of a storm?
Yeah, one gripe I'd pick with it is just like the use of the like, I'm gay as like comedic foil. It just feels like, with this movie, I think there's a difficulty where you're watching something that was made 20 years ago, but it's set much further back.
Yeah.
And what is kind of socially accepted.
Right.
You can give it a little bit of a free pass of like, it's not being held to full like 2001 values.
Being in this closet in the 70s.
Yeah.
Was probably realistic, and also making a joke of it in the turn of the millennium was also probably
there was still problematic use of gay characters in 2001, and I think like to throw that on a character who's really given no other kind
it's literally the only line he has in the entire life, surely that was very difficult to be gay at that time.
Use of that for comedy, I was just a little bit like,
I do think by and large it does age well, because as you say, it is looking at things that happened in 1973. I think one thing that I didn't love, actually, is there's a couple of chief laughs where, God, we're talking so much about Jimmy Fallon on this. That was a twist I did not expect, where he says, you know, if you, do you think Jagger's still going to be out there when you're in his 50s? Like, don't make me laugh. And you're like, well, we all know he's out there in his 70s. Yeah. And then also when they talk about that there is a Mojo, it's like a brand new machine where you can transmit pages over the telephone and it takes 18 minutes a page.
Yeah.
And I think the film is at its best when it's completely immersed, and as you said, it's a very immersive experience in the world, and it doesn't have that sort of wink wink nudge nudge, you know, here comes
bringing
the future,
bringing you back to the present.
Because even actually one of the things in that vein, the graduation speech, where it's I seen the principal saying, you'll all have home computers and there'll be flying electric cars in 20 years,
and both of those are seen as equally realistic as well, you know, aspirational.
And it was just like, the computers worked out, but the flying car is like, whoop, still not haven't quite, got them.
Exactly. Elon Musk has his way.
Silent ones, he says. Exactly. Yeah, no, there were really like, interesting moments there. I guess something I was thinking about, I've lost track of my thought. I think you mentioned something about kind of the cheap laughs. It bides a like really interesting question about like periodical movies or dramas and things like that. Like, what's the responsibility now when you're making them?
And I do think that
to honor the problematic elements of it or do something slightly interesting or new with it. And I guess that's what I was asking myself throughout. Like, I'm enjoying this. There's things I'm uncomfortable knowing what I know now. But also just like,
I think it really comes down to the lens that it's kind of shown in. Like, does the filmmaker show this in a way that like acknowledges it's slightly problematic or is it a glorification and that? And I do think the movie overall balanced that very well in terms of
I think it balanced it well in terms of not being offensive and aging well, right? But I thought that there was also, it skimmed a line where I was just like, I don't want it to overly be overbearing in terms of making commentary on the whole culture.
It didn't really explore that idea of, as we say, of these very young groupies and these men. But also, I do think that it is not the responsibility of every film to do everything, if you know what I mean. I think that wasn't the story that was being told, and I'm not sure how well it would sit with that. I think that is absolutely a story and a discussion worth having, but I don't think every piece of art
has to necessarily but I guess what I did appreciate out of it is that it kind of honoured every character's or it kind of empowered every character in a way as much as it kind of showed a flawed aspect of them, which I was like, okay, that's like realistic to humans, right? Like we like all of them, but we also know that we're annoyed by them, and
I think there's no one in there like, you know, William is seen as like painfully earnest and very naive and whatever,
right?
And also painfully uncool, but hey, as David and I have discussed repeatedly on this podcast, we were also I mean, we still are, but definitely back then we're terminally uncool as well, so you do identify with them. But nobody is, as you say, perfect, and particularly the rock stars are deeply, deeply flawed people, which kind of brings us on to the other scene that I wanted to talk about. So after Penny Lane has been, the other Band-Aids very much sort of dust themselves off, and are one of them goes to England with Deep Purple. I think one of them's on tour with Humble Pie, like they're, you know, this is their life for them. And as Russell says to William after he's horrified by this poker exchange, that this is a circus and nobody wants to say goodbye. Everyone's just trying to stay on the road.
Yeah.
So, but with Penny Lane, at this point, she is obviously in love with Russell. So follows him to New York, even though William very much tries to dissuade her from doing so, is kicked out of the restaurant that the band are in, goes back to the hotel that she is staying in with, I believe Led Zeppelin is what's mentioned, and also gets Jay Baruchel's Led Zeppelin super fan is the one who tells William where she is. So many faces in this film, man. But
we didn't even touch on Anna Paquin for his Balfour.
I know
there's still time, but just to finish just this particular thread, she then takes a bunch of Quaaludes. I personally don't think she was deliberately trying to overdose, but I think she's so miserable she takes a bunch of drugs and booze. And William finds her, she's about to pass out, calls a doctor who pumps her stomach and whatever. One of the things that bothers me about that film is he does kiss her unconsensually, which I wasn't wild, so, and also seems kind of against that character, what that character would do, because as in another fabulous phone call with his mother, Fairuza Balk, who is Scarlet, I think,
Sapphire,
sorry, a colour beginning with S, is one of the Band-Aids. She has a fantastic conversation with his mother, who rings looking for her, saying that she's raised a good man, they're all looking out for him, he's still a virgin, by the way. This is the maid, and hangs. That's more than I've ever said to my own parents. This is the maid, by the way, and hangs up. And she had always said, she says she's always said to Penny Lane, it's don't let all these men fall in love with you. But one of them actually then saves her life.
Yeah.
But he does William is very much portrayed, and like, I don't think it's just he's a nice guy in the sense that we say now where you're not actually that nice. I think he is fundamentally quite a good person, but then he kisses her, and then while she's having her stomach like pumped, it's oddly like sexualized or
the
romanticized.
Fairy tales that you're kind of like told as a kid of like Sleeping Beauty and coming up on the girl, like he's young, admittedly.
Yeah, he is
and
very,
like,
yeah.
Also, we're talking about the 70s where and misogyny in a much worse place, as bad as it is now, but in a much worse place then. Would question just like not to like characterize him as like he did this thing, therefore that is a sign that he is evil, but it's just more
it was opportunistic.
Definitely,
and it was opportunistic, and I feel like maybe if we were kind of like if we were skirting the kind of the woke approach to it, like what would a non-woke person be like, lol, that's funny, because maybe this is like essentially the only opportunity that he got, and would that be comedy? I don't know what it was like watching it now. That's exactly what I was thinking. It was like, if I was a teenager, would have been like, lol, you know, get your kiss, I guess. I don't know. Like, I like that was the duality of what my mind was trying to think. But definitely, ultimately, I was just a bit like, could have avoided that. That was not necessary, but okay, fair, you know? Yeah. There were, a couple of moments like that. But yeah, I guess like something else that like really was interesting and kind of like burning my mind as a question throughout this, looking at it from the music industry aspect, was just like how much of this actually holds true to now, like in terms of, you know, portraying an outward appearance of a band that really could make or break them, and what cancel culture, like, you know, what would cancel culture have been then? Like, was he cancel culture?
I think it was very much non-existent. I think it was,
sure,
as witnessed from having, you know, 14-year-old girlfriends, whatever. I think it was pretty difficult to get cancelled in the
70s. Well, also,
even just like the idea of the power that a publication like Rolling Stones would have, like, if they printed it, that was gospel in a way.
Exactly, yeah.
So the idea
of the make or break of, many artists,
as a member of the public who reads that, like, who are you to contend against, like, the elders of pop music knowledge kind of thing.
And also, like, what made the make or break? Because, like, the things that we glorify out of that era and even out of this movie are all the contentious things that we're talking about. Like, so I was just like, oh, this is really interesting that he can make or break the story. So, like, what is the appeal and what's the story that people wanted to hear about these bands? Because I would have assumed it was the rock and roll, the crazy stories, all of these things that really just like put them at this other realm of like demigodness and made you want to go to the concerts and see it live and see it all kind of play out. Whereas nowadays in kind of pop culture and for at least the elites of the elites that are like nearly almost famous, like you don't want any of that to get out because it could actually be damaging to contracts and commercials and like it has like a monetary effect. Whereas back then it just had the opposite. So I thought that there was just real interesting because like I guess at the end of the movie, you know, Philip Seymour Hoffman and him kind of pose this question of like, you know, like the true artists and people that are like really, you know, meant to make it and kind of
the art that lasts is not by beautiful people because they don't experience pain and loss and like the and that music is really the best music comes from the guys who don't get the girls is basically and is very much Lester Bangs' whole, I think, theory through the whole thing. Like, you know, and I have to say I very much side with him on this particular part that he calls Jim Morrison a buffoon. So I think there is that, and again, Jim Morrison, like a very, very beautiful man.
So
there
is
that idea of, and like Lester Bangs' whole thing is about like rock and roll is dead, it's over, it's been commercialized.
That I thought that commentary was really interesting because I was like, if you thought it was bad then, like you have no idea. So like what the 90s kind of pop and kind of classic, you know. Like
but then there's that argument, and like Jeff says something really interesting where he talks about people being scared to admit that they want to be popular, and he's like, that I've studied the entire history of music and the best songs are usually the popular ones, or in the words of Paul McCartney, of course I like to play the hits are the best ones. So I think that there is, and this idea of something pop or popular being toxic, you know, is really interesting as well, and I think it's probably something we could go on about indefinitely, and I think it might almost be a topic for another podcast, guys. David, do you want to delve into your back catalogue there?
Will we get that theme music going?
What's in the What's in the box?
Yes, it's what's in the box. So this is the section of the show where I go through the archives of my bedroom in my parents' home, where I try and find something from my childhood connected to the movie.
Brilliant.
So for Almost Famous, it's one that I think I came to a little bit later than my teenage years, but it definitely showed up in my teenage fashion. What I have here, it's I describe that as probably paisley print.
Yeah, I think that is what paisley is.
V70s looking shirt that
I hope you still wear the shirt now.
Russell would have worn that shirt.
Unfortunately, this shirt does not fit me anymore. The COVID pains were unfortunate. But it's funny because I find when I go to like live music now, or I'm tending to be the oldest person in the crowds there, and I see all the kids in their 90s clothes, and I'm like, oh, 90s.
So retro.
I wore it the first time around, so that makes you officially old,
but
I think.
Yeah, no, but it's like when I think the 70s look that I was trying to pull off in early 2000s and then do like the math, it's like, oh, they're doing what I did.
They legitimately think that's the 50s.
The pain of knowing that this is that far back for them.
This is how rude that whole scenario is that I had a gig on the 29th of October, so like Halloween weekend, and I dressed as Dion from Clueless.
Fantastic.
And so I'm part of this.
You and Lupita Nyong'o also, so like extremely cool costume.
You know, just trying to
me and my good friend
rub shoulders with my tethered off in Hollywood, you know, doing my thing. But someone in the band that I was in was like, "Oh, are you dressed as Iggy Azalea?" Like that 90s vibe. And I was I'm gonna puke in someone's ear. I was so insulted that I kind of took half of it off, and I was just like, "Yeah, sure."
Really love Iggy.
No one
She's
gets
very
it. They're all like 21 and
we
under.
Stand your Dion.
Thank you. I had to actually like make it very explicit then in social media. But,
so one last question that we would like to ask you. Obviously, you are now no longer the last person to see Almost Famous, but is there a film that you really like that you would think more people should see? Is there something that you are really fond of and that you're surprised more people haven't watched?
Good question. Yes. I mean, I'm a fan of musicals, so I would say the one that was big with Lady Gaga recently, A Star Is Born, but the 1973 one.
Oh, Barbra Streisand.
That shirt would feature in that.
Yeah.
Clearly. Yeah.
Big fan. Yeah. That is one that I'm always like, you haven't seen it, especially in light of it being such a popular.
Yeah, and I think people, obviously, most people, I think, know A Star Is Born has had multiple iterations, but I think the Judy Garland and Lady Gaga versions would be much better known than the Barbra Streisand and
weird.
Then a previous
I assumed
one.
That the Barbra Streisand would have been more.
Yeah, I think, again, one of the things that it was at the time, but I don't think it's necessarily stood the test of time in the same way.
Right. Yeah. Well, yes. Yeah.
Yeah. And also, as we say, we kind of recycle things. So perhaps as the 70s becomes into vogue again, we're going to be looking at it. And if, you know, Barbara ever decides to grace us with another film, we might look back at that. And for me, I think I'm going to go to some, again, we're going to stay in the music universe, something that's very much along the same lines as Almost Famous, but from a previous decade. It's That Thing You Do, which was not only starring, but I believe also directed by Tom Hanks. And it's about a jazz drummer who joins a rock band, throws down a 4/4, or a pop band, a ballad band, if you will, throws down a 4/4 beat, and completely changes the direction of the band. And they have an incredibly, incredibly earwormy one-hit wonder. Oh. And it's about the rise and fall of that. And you have, you know, Liv Tyler, you have Charlize Theron, you have a lot of like faces kind of coming in it. But it is.
Have you seen it?
No, I haven't seen it.
It's a really, really lovely film. And also, like, you know, who doesn't love a bit of Tom Hanks? And it is an era.
He's in
that,
it as well.
He is in it, I believe, as their manager. I'm trying to remember if that is his exact role, because I think there's obviously a couple of people of that nature floating around. But it is a time period that was really, really dear to him as well. So, and a story that he really wanted to tell. And also the idea, like with Stillwater, you have Almost Famous and they kind of become famous by the end of the film as a rock band. But these guys are one hit wonders, so there is something really interesting in that. So I'd really recommend that. What about you, David?
Well, keeping in the theme of music, my selection goes a little less serious. Josie and the Pussycats from 2001.
A banger.
I feel that this movie is critically underrated.
Never heard of it, I'm not gonna lie.
It's fantastic. So it's based on the Archie comic books that Riverdale also has spun out of, but this is long before the Riverdale franchise has begun.
Yeah.
And Rachel Lee Cook plays the lead, flanked
is
by Zoe Saldana and
Tara Reid.
Ah. And it has also fantastic comedic performances from Alan Cumming and Parker Posey. And what I love about it is that it was kind of seen as a little bit of a flop at the time and didn't hit the kind of commercial success, but it's an incredible satire of the kind of 2000s era TRL. And they very like self-aware put in product placement almost as like a comedic gag within the film. The entire soundtrack was done, like the singing voice of Rachel Lee Cook's character.
Is it Rosario Dawson and not Zoe Saldana?
Sorry, Rosario yeah. Dawson, you're correct.
Apologies.
But the singing voice was done by Kay Hanley.
Okay.
Who was the lead singer of Letters to Cleo, a band who...
10 Things I Hate About You, baby.
Closed out the movie, yeah. No, so Kay did like the entire soundtrack with a band, which was one of like heavy rotation in my teenage years. And
Chicks
in 2016, it was the 15th anniversary. I was living in San Francisco at the time, but flew down to LA for a launch party for the vinyl release.
No
the
way.
First time ever on vinyl of the soundtrack, where they had all three of the band members and Kay Hanley on stage for a Q&A, as well as Kay Hanley performing
Incredible.
The tracks live. It was a life-changing experience.
Spiritual moment.
Did you get to say hi, or at least just even look guys?
Oh, no, this was like a full-blown auditorium. I was just one of the crowd. But
you
like,
were fanning out. Yeah. I know I say this every week, but as our listeners probably know by now, if David goes for something, he goes hard.
Go very hard.
Might as well. Yeah, go hard or go home.
Well, I think that's a lovely note to end what is ultimately a podcast and a film about what it means to be a fan. So thanks for sharing that story, David. Sunita, thank you for coming in to talk to us.
Thank you for having
me.
This is great chat. Lovely. Yeah, and thanks for putting me to the exercise of watching Almost Famous. I'm glad.
And you're like, if you need to check out the director's cut at some point, you know where to find it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, no, definitely. I definitely need to see what I missed out on.
So that was a gorgeous walk down memory lane. I think for us, Almost Famous serves a dual purpose of being nostalgic for the 70s and then us getting to be nostalgic for like the early aughties when it came out.
We talked definitely about the fashion throwback of that time, and I feel like there was a real 70s moment in those two early 2000s.
And I've noticed that we do have a pattern both of films that we've talked about and films that are coming up later in the series. A lot of stuff is hitting in or around its 20th anniversary. And I think with the profile of guests that we've had on, that makes sense because it's films that people saw in their teens and early 20s, which are obviously impactful. But again, it is the idea of these were films everybody saw. Whereas in the, you know, that everyone went to the cinema, or whatever, whereas as we continue to have streamers and diversification of channels and whatever, that maybe we're not all watching the same thing again because it's all happening. So maybe it's not all happening for all of us together.
Yes, indeed. So what is happening this week as well, actually, I'm just going to shamelessly plug my own musical endeavors. I'll be DJing at The Big Romance on Friday evening, early evening. With Dublin Record Club, we're going to be doing a Damon Albarn throwback night in honour of his National Concert Hall shows that he has in Dublin this week. So yeah, just plugging my other little side projects there outside of the wonderful world of Last One to See.
David is a multi-hyphenate, guys. He has a lot of stuff going on. And speaking of being booked and busy, our guest Sunita, also, it's all happening for her.
Yeah, so there's a couple of things that I wanted to shout out because obviously we recorded the episode a few weeks ago and she has many things that have come on the radar since. So there's the release of Ascension, which is a single with her project sister Phoenix that's coming on the way. Other than that, she can be found doing her normal interviewing and podcast bits at Point of Intersection on Dublin Digital Radio. And in April, as part of the Cork Festival in Galway, on April 7th, she's going to be interviewing Stephanie Phillips, who wrote Why Solange Matters, which sounds like a brilliant night. So yeah, lots of Sunita business going on.
Very much booked and busy. It is all happening for Sunita. And it's all happening for us because we have another podcast coming up in 2 weeks' time. And David, who is our lovely guest and what are they the last one to see?
We have the wonderful Jen Gannon, who is the last one to see The Notebook.
Queen of Instagram, queen of my heart. Yeah, whether she wants to be known as queen of The Notebook remains to be seen.
Queen of opinions about The Notebook for show.
But yeah, really looking forward to getting that one out. I think it is a film that a lot of our generation had seen, except for Jen. And had you seen it, David?
Years back had seen it, but relegated it to the, like, that's not cool, that's like romance movies when I was a teenager kind of thing. And how appropriate, our first episode post-Valentine's Day to be announcing The Notebook. Like,
I mean, if our timing was better, we would probably have had it as a Valentine's Day episode, but we're not so good at these things. Listen, David, you have a whole pile on your plate, including prepping for your upcoming gig, so I'm going to let you go.
Fantastic.
Thanks everyone for listening to us. Thank you very much, Sunita, for joining us for a great chat. And we are glad that you're no longer the last one to see Almost Famous.
And a final plug to follow us on social media. We're at The Last One to See on Twitter and Instagram. And we really appreciate any of your ratings or reviews on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. The ratings have been coming in strong, but we'd love to see more little reviews. So we'll leave it at that. We'll see you next time.
This This podcast was brought to you by The Shift. For more like this, check out theshift.ie.